You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Well, here we are, episode 32. How are you, Nick?
32. I'm well, thank you, Blake. We're almost at my age in episodes.
It's quite a few more to go. What are you going to do for your 50th this year?
That's a good point. Imagine if I was 50. How is 50?
It's a distant memory. Okay. So this week we are talking to Alison Pennington. Who is Alison Pennington?
Well, we were introduced to Alison and we were really interested because we didn't think we'd actually have an economist on our show.
What's an economist do? Or should we wait till Alison explains what an economist
well,
does?
Well, I definitely think let's wait to hear how Alison explains it. And this is more than just a story of an economist. This is the life that she led to get her to be an economist is intriguing, and the impact that she's having on people's lives is quite amazing.
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely inspirational. It's funny, you know, when we first read about Alison, it was like, okay, political economist. But that's just such a small part of who she is and what she does and what makes her up. She's absolutely come from a world that had very little and worked tooth and nail to achieve what she's achieved. We should really throw to Alison and tell her story, shouldn't we?
And just stick through the end because there's just the most amazing thing ever happens on the Doolanders at the end of this podcast.
I can't believe you've just said it's the most amazing thing ever.
It's incredible.
It's not.
Let's hear from Alison. Blake, do you like stories of people doing?
I love stories of people doing, Nick.
Well, if you out there like stories of people doing and you want us to make more stories of people doing, then like this podcast, subscribe and tell your mates, because the more people we have listening, the more episodes we can make, and that's better for everyone out there who's doing or wants to do.
And as Arnold would say,
do it.
I thought he said I'll be back.
Bang, I love that clap of sound. Thank you, Alison. Welcome to the Doolanders. How are you?
Just great this morning because it's a great opportunity to look at faces while I talk rather than sit behind my computer.
How has your start to 21 been?
I tried my best to hold on to all of the kernels of calm that I got in the holiday break and carry them through, but it was really just hitting the ground running. It's been a busy start to the year, but I think that's been the case for a lot of people.
Yeah. Sure has. It feels like in some ways that the those light bulb moments of 2020 where we said, you know, let's slow down a bit, let's shorten the to-do list, just sort of went out the window and we've just screamed out of the blocks out of 21.
Oh, absolutely. One of the things for me, which I'm sure like a lot of listeners will have some experience of, is you have an idea about how you want to relate to something like alcohol, and everyone makes, they come back from their holidays like, oh no, no more drinking, don't need to do it. But then you understand its role in the overall work schedule, you know, immediately I was just like, all right, that's what the glass of wine is for. And
replacing the commute time.
Yeah. More productive with all this time. But it's just like the easiest way to create a break from a work day to like a non-work time.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is not a, if anyone has issues with alcohol, please get support.
That's right. Hey, could you tell us and our listeners, what do you do?
Now, what I'm doing, my title is Senior Economist and I work at the Centre for Future Work.
That sounds cool.
Yeah, it's super cool. It's futuristic. Mm. If you put future in the title, you know, that's how you become important in all the debates, which is part of the strategy, right?
It's working.
So I work in a think tank and the think tank's called the Australia Institute, which is a large progressive think tank based out of Canberra. And they do a whole range of different issues covering, research on the role of government, taxation, environmental policy, a lot of work on climate change. But the Centre for Future Work, where I am, we do work on all things jobs and employment and what it means for an everyday person to live in the economy, and how their jobs relate to broader trends around them. So it's a role that is requires lots of different skill sets. It's really demanding and it keeps me on my toes, which is why I love it. And it allows me to bring together all my different sort of experience and my really my love of people. And I get to sort of do the ideas work and then I get to communicate it to people, right down to, you know, workers on the ground. So it's a real privilege, and yeah, I'm lucky to say that's my work at the moment.
That sounds pretty cool. And hey, we're going to dig right into that just a little bit later. You walked into what we call the studio here. It's really just upstairs at
in the chapel
in my house, and I said, and you said, you know, this looks like a, what did you say? It looks like a church. You were actually born in the city of churches, weren't you?
Oh, I was. I was born in Adelaide, in the western suburbs of Adelaide.
Yeah,
still plenty of churches in the western suburbs, and yeah, I come from a, my mum's raised Catholic, yeah, and come from a big, you know, Irish Catholic family, a lot of those out in the port. But, yeah, no, church wasn't a big part of my life, but it's really not a big part of many people's lives in Adelaide, but apparently we've got a lot of them. I think it was some product of, you know, Adelaide being settled by the aristocratic sort of landowners of England, mm, and they wanted their English gardens and they wanted their churches, and that's why there's a lot of those around.
Was Port Adelaide Football Club your main religion or...?
Good segue. Absolutely, yeah. Football in the western suburbs, or in really, I think, in southern states. This is something that Victoria, Tasmania, and South Australia all share. But yeah, Port Adelaide, I had more of an experience of going to the SANFL games. So we yeah, the local comp was really, really vibrant in my area, and also the right down to the amateur sort of clubs as well. And yeah, it's was part of football clubs, along with, you know, the schools, workplaces, and unions, and community clubs. They're all sort of woven into a really strong fabric in Adelaide's West, yeah, and part of how people understand themselves. And yeah, Port Adelaide is, I would say, I supported the Woodville West Torrens Eagles at the local level,
yep,
but as soon as the AFL comp was created, I mean, you know, I couldn't say no.
You had to.
Absolutely, I had to. Yeah. And, you know, my mum used to grow up going to watch the Port Adelaide Magpies play. Yeah. So it was there was a link there. Yeah. And, yeah, Port Adelaide brings a lot of joy to my life. Absolutely. And I think when you do really intense work that requires you to always be engaging at this high sort of ideas level, you need things that allow you to connect with people and ground you with people. And it's not just that. Like, I could write a thesis on football. It's how much I love it. Like, I think it's just a brilliant, creative, you know, collective game. It's just so good.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, we look forward to that thesis.
I wonder if that sound will come out without the visual.
I wish we had a video running. That was amazing. Hey, as a young girl, you know, running around the streets of the city of churches, we are thinking data spreadsheets, the economy, yeah, how am I going to fix this? What was life like as a young girl? What were you thinking?
Well, so I grew up in a working class family that didn't always have all the resources it needed. My dad was a plumber when I was young, and my mum was trained to be a nurse. So both my parents were young parents. My mum was 18 when she got together with my dad.
Yeah.
And they raised four kids with the resources they had, not a lot of stuff. But we were skint, but we were proud. We were told, like, we might not have all the things we need, but you should be, yeah, proud of who you are and what we are.
Nice.
So, yeah, I think that we were sort of beneficiaries of the tail end of a time of, you know, the glory days of Australian working class culture, when there was that sense of agency. Like we could pull ourselves up by bootstraps. That was sort of the ethos. But at the same time, I think as a young girl growing up in this environment where there was so many people, not just in my family but my community, who were struggling, I felt helpless. You know, it's not enough to be able to look at it and to say, well, look, I'm going to own this struggle, own these problems. At some point you have to think about what am I going to do about them.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we, in this sort of very working class ethos of our household, like we all got jobs young, we paid board early. We were, you know, part of our community. We'd wake up at 5:30 to do our chores so that the work around the house was shared. And so there was that sense of like, what are we doing? What's our purpose? And I think what I concluded from this time was that, yeah, I wanted to be a part of change. And it's a long journey that, I mean, I've had like 27 jobs in my short life.
27 jobs?
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, because like every crappy, you know, low-paid, casual, insecure job under the sun, really. But ones on which I learned a lot and I got a lot of insights and experience. But like it's going to be hard to, I guess, you can be part of the community as an awesome barista. You know, the baristas are the heart and soul of many communities. But if you want to materially start to intervene into things that are determining the lives of millions of people, you got to start making new conclusions. And that was, at least that was my, not an ambition, just it was like it was a necessity.
Right. I found it. You saw it as a necessity.
Everything I do is a necessity.
Okay.
Yeah, it's quite overwhelming because because it's a drive that's just like my appetite to learn new things and to do things and to try and be as effective as possible is just, it's constant and it's hard to turn off. That's why I watch footy.
That'll help.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, having in a good some yell. Ways it'll help. Yeah, well, yeah. Get that emotion out. Music played a big part in your family in terms of, I guess, bringing you all together and sticking you all together. Tell us a bit about that and what style of music was it?
So when we were young, our parents were in a Celtic bush band, which was very in vogue. It was very 1980s of its time. And
did Celtic bush bands have mullets or?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Big mullets and like those instruments with planks of wood and bottle caps tied to them.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. So my dad's a fiddle player.
Yeah.
And my mum's a singer and she played guitar in this band. They're called the Blinky Bill Bush Band.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is there anything on YouTube that we can see or?
There'll be some old memorabilia, I think, because they were associated with certain organisations. There'd be things in like the museum the library or something. Yep. So music was always, I guess, alongside that experience of working hard, just making ends meet, not having what you needed. Music was just like the glue that brought us all together. Mm. And it was a totally different experience to what I found about music when I, you know, went and studied it in university actually. But music was just like living and breathing, same as poetry and the arts in general. It's just what you do when you got together. So, you know, I have fond memories as a child of going to see my parents play and, you know, the club full of this big old house of like people stomping and jeering and singing along with, you know, collectivist music, songs that bring people together, make them feel good. And yeah, so music was kind of a non-negotiable. But also none of us ever questioned it. It was just a given. So I played flute, was my first instrument, and I loved singing. So I did choir, and my older brother's a drummer. He was in a grunge band. The one below me, he played trumpet. And then the youngest is just, he's the greatest of all of us put together. He has huge talents. He's a jazz guitarist, lives in New York.
Super cool. So he's as good as the three of his siblings put together. Is that what you say?
Absolutely.
Wow.
Yeah.
He must be super talented.
Oh, ridiculous. I remember when he first picked up a guitar.
Yeah.
And he was so good. His ears were so good. It was he was listening to Jeff Buckley and the best thing of the 90s, you know. And he was just listening to, I think it was Grace, and he was just immediately playing it on guitar, just listening around and playing around and just finding all the notes. And I was like, oh, this kid's special.
Yeah.
But, you know, we all feel that way about our younger siblings probably.
No. sorry to Hope, my youngest sister. So at any time throughout your childhood, did you think there's a career in music for me? Because correct me if I'm wrong, you did at one point think I might become an Irish dancer. Is that right?
That's so cruel. So I grew up with boys and I played footy. I had short hair. I wore boys' clothes because it was actually all that was available to me. But there was one moment in my life when I was like, I want to be a bloody princess. I want to be an Irish dancer. I want to have the hair and the curls and the dresses. And it was just magic. I was so into Irish dancing and I did watch River Dance a lot, which I've been told is not an authentic representation of Irish dancing. But I really wanted to do it, but we didn't have the money. And like lots of things as kids, we were told it was just impossible. Mm. So I just watched, you know, the girl at my school who would come and flaunt it in my face and just pull all these sick dance moves. And I would just be like, oh, I wish I could do that. And to this day, I still think I've got potential. You know?
Well,
never ever lose hope.
No, because they like Riverdance. They, I reckon they spent far more time in the air than on the ground. Like they just floated for about an hour, didn't they?
Totally. And that's why their legs are like tree trunks. They're so muscly that it's because as soon as they hit the ground, they're up in the air again, like kangaroo tails.
Wow, I like that analogy. That is amazing. Mm. So talking about hopping and jumping, where did you leap from through? Sorry, that's a really bad segue. So where, like, as you got into your teenage years and you were doing a bunch of jobs, where did you decide that, you know, you wanted to take your career and what you were passionate about?
I think my story is going to be – it kind of rubs against the nature of there being any plan or any ability to determine what that career would be.
Yeah.
I feel like the what really got things started, like it got me out of that cycle of, you know, I was cleaning, I was music teaching, working for myself, you know, hospitality jobs. What got me out of that grind of sort of the precariat was my first full-time secure job, which was in the Commonwealth government. And that was huge for me. I was on the dole in like pretty dire poverty really when I was doing my master's in Sydney for years. And it wasn't until I got to the end of that, I'd been driven by just this complete passion and overwhelming sense of what I was learning and what I was, the tools I was getting were so important and were going to make me a better thinker. And you know, that had a value unto itself. So it wasn't until I got to the end of that master's that I was like, holy shit, I need to get a job. And what can I get? And I think I'd already sort of resigned myself to the state of the labour market being terrible. This is post-GFC, which was really when our labour market start to collapse in terms of graduate entry jobs. And so my expectations were low in terms of if I was preparing myself if it didn't work out, but like I was aiming very high. So I was applying for jobs in the Commonwealth government, and I landed one. And it was, you know, for a whole year of that job, I felt you know, a combination of guilty that I got a job when so many of my other peers were still struggling. I felt like I had to apply that workerist ethic, and I was always doing hours, overtime hours. But I also got a pretty strong sense then that I knew stuff and I knew how to synthesize large volumes of information, think strategically, write briefs for ministers, and I could see all the cogs of policy making turning. And then it's very quickly I was like, all right, I need to find a way to better influence those cogs. I don't want to be inside of this like bureaucratic hellhole, but I want to find a way to influence it.
Cool.
Which is what got me to here. I guess that's the point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll come back to the way that you influence those cogs today. We'll come back to that in a minute. You know, so many of the people that we've spoken to on the Do Landers have had the opportunity to go to university and, you know, they've worked really hard to double down on their study and that's really propelled them to what they do today. Like, study, so you're the first person in your family to go to uni, but shit, you worked hard outside of just the studying to actually enable you to go, right?
It's something that is not understood properly, I think, in the Australian sort of public discussion about what it means to be a student. Like, if like the idea that you would be fully supported by a parent in terms of, you know, your study costs and, you know, a roof over your head and all of that. It's not the reality for a lot of poorer university students. And, you know, youth allowance payments are pittance, really. They're nowhere near enough. And they should be much, much higher. It would have made my life a lot easier. I think my turn to academia, because my family was in construction, right, and my brothers were doing blue collar work. I think my turn to university was like, well, this is clearly the next step for me, and I knew I just had to work at it. But that meant literally working at the same time, and actually having to, you know, take a long time to do my studies because I couldn't manage full time. Because I had to hold down other jobs, and those jobs were, you know, very meaningful and important to me, like music teaching. But that was only of a day of work. I was also, you know, scrubbing shitters in at the airport as a cleaner, which is, you know, also important, meaningful work actually, because you get to feel like you've succeeded at the end of the day, which is, you don't get that in, I think, in the kind of work I do sometimes. But it was a real struggle, and it meant that there was often just this big gulf between myself and what I consider, you know, middle class and more well-off students who got to really give all of themselves to their studies. For me, I had like family obligations, I had work obligations, and, you know, just keeping your head above water was already like the first port of call. And then whatever's left, you would apply to your thinking. So it was really in those, my undergrad days, where my mind was expanding, and I knew that university was bringing me tools that no one else in my family had access to yet. But it was also where I started, I think, to develop, some pretty very high expectations of myself, right? Because I saw this as the tools to get me out of poverty, and I was so desperate to get them and, you know, to keep expanding my mind. But, yeah, I have lots of memories of sitting in computer rooms on campus till 3 a.m. or, you know, horrible sleeping patterns and waking up in the middle of the night to write points on essays because something's just come to my mind, and just that real sporadic kind of erratic sort of work, which, you know, is a skill set and it's something that I use for my work now, but I think as a product of just like the level of stress that's on a human brain, when you should just be able to just like read and study, because that's the purpose of you getting those skills, right?
Yeah.
As hard as that was, how much of an influence does that have on how good you are at what you do today?
Like I've noticed as I've moved through my working life, like I'm resilient. And I think that growing up in the kind of environment I did means that what affects people, some people, doesn't affect me. I have a very high bar of what I can tolerate. But it's like a double-edged sword, you know, that can also not work in your favour if you, have a work ethic that's really, means that you don't sleep, for instance. I think it goes both ways.
So you went to the University of Adelaide. Did social science there. Went to Uni of Sydney. Studied political economy. You also studied jazz. Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Where was that?
Also University of Adelaide.
Right.
Yeah. So I guess it's in the realm of what you think you can do when you're young. For me at my school, we didn't have universities that came and said, these are your choices. We had the army tell you you can reach your dreams through the forces. And yeah, so a lot of people I went to school with didn't know much about university and didn't know about those choices. What I did know as a 16, 17-year-old was that I loved jazz. I was totally so into it and so into music. And it was the first framework, I guess, that I could see that helped me to understand my life, my family, my community, and to put that into a form that I could express myself. And so I auditioned for the Adelaide Conservatorium of Music, which was in its time, you know, and still is a prestigious institution.
Yeah.
And I was admitted into the Bachelor of Jazz Improvisation, which was wild to me, amazing. I did it for about a year. And then I went to South America at the end of that year because I got a scholarship because I did well. I finished at the top of my school. So they gave out scholarships to basically low socioeconomic students. And I used the money to go to South America.
As you should.
Life learning, you know.
Yeah. How's the jazz scene in South America?
Oh, so good.
Yeah.
I was really into Brazilian music. So, and I still am. And it was a big passion of mine. I actually developed a singing duo with a guitarist and we were playing, you know, various gigs around Adelaide and a few interstate. And yeah, that was, music was a big part of my decision to go there. I kind of hung out on the streets of Brazil and learnt all the local music. And they've got this songbook in Brazil where everyone just knows, you know, 100 amazing, beautiful bossa nova samba songs. So I got a whole bunch of them under my belt and did that for a while. Yeah, but then I came back after, I think it was partly because of that, the depth of that experience of music being part of culture rather than in a stuffy institution, which is what I felt I was doing, where I would get up and scat for like old blokes who would be like, yeah, I'll give you a 70 out of 100, like without any explanation.
And just, right.
The idea that I would be graded on music, it was very jarring. It's a weird concept. Yeah, yeah. It's a subjective art form, right? So I think that experience meant when I came back, I was like, oh, yeah, in the formalized music education isn't for me.
Yep.
But formalized political and historical education, probably yes. Mm. I'll do that.
So you scat.
It was a lot of scatting going on in that degree for sure.
For those people listening who don't know what scatting is, I'm going to ask you at the end to scat with Nick because Nick loves to scat.
Oh, yeah.
You'll find out how true that is.
That is,
because I'll throw to you.
Yeah, that's right. That is, it's not true. But for those people who are listening who don't know what is scatting?
Scatting was, it emerged at a time in the jazz music movement where vocalists started hanging out with big bands. And it was a way for vocalists to, you know, improvise like any other instrument does. Be part of the great art form that is jazz. So, you know, some famous jazz vocalists who are phenomenal scatters would be Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, Carmen McRae. Billie Holiday didn't do a lot of scatting. She was more, she sang more, lyrics. But, yeah, scatting is, creating melodies and putting sounds to them because when you're on your toes and coming up with melodies on the spot, you can't come up with words at the same time. So it's just it's a whole bunch of scooby-doo-doop and doobops. Yeah, and actually there was a running joke when I was in uni among the vocalists of like anyone who could get bomfrang into their scat. Into their...
Bomfrang.
Bomfrang.
Into their scat.
Into their scat.
Doing really well.
Yeah.
Okay.
They get legendary status because
I'll remember that for a little later. We'll see if you can slide that into a scat.
It's so harsh on the ear. Like, it's terrible.
Okay. Well, it sounds terrible. Anyway, We're going to move on to what you're doing today shortly, but you've been teaching music to a bunch of people for a long time, which is feels so, I don't know, opposed to what you're doing today in your day job. What level of, like, when you think about what you do, how do you think about teaching music as opposed to what you're doing today around, you know, your work with the Future Work Institute? Like, what do you get out of it? Is it different?
Mm. In some ways, for me, economics and music, they flow from the same river, or they are streams that come into the same river. And they are intensely creative pursuits, actually. And they are a process of looking at the complexity of the world and finding ways to describe it. And also, it's a process of imagining a better world. Actually, both music and economics is that. So for me, though, these worlds do come together. But in terms of the overall experience of being a music teacher and then now working really behind my desk, very much alone, on, you know, ideas and concepts and research and, you know, spreadsheets. I think it's actually remembering those experiences of being on the ground and being a part of people's lives and influencing those lives in a positive way that keeps a bit of fire in my belly for the work I do. But it's a constant balancing, or it's something that's in my mind a lot. I think when the pandemic hit, I thought I have to get closer to people quick. I hope that I can incorporate singing teaching back into my life in some way, because I think I need some sort of antidote to the constant high-level policy work that I'm doing. I need some way to speak to and to relate to people. But also I have aspects of this in my job. So I do, you know, write research, publish it, talk about it in the media.
Mm-hmm.
But at the, you know, I also have the privilege of being able to explain that research, you know, in straightforward and easy communicable ways to working people on the ground.
Yeah.
So
you're telling stories.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think there are a lot of economists, and arguably too many of them, but there aren't many that, like, people aren't telling stories about how the economy works that makes sense to people who live in the economy. So I think that communication requires a lot of creative work, and I pull on my music experience and my teaching experience quite a lot in what I do. They're different, but I guess I feel like I'm building on the experience I got as a music teacher as well.
Yeah. Nice one. You did all this study. You found yourself in so your Uni of Adelaide, Uni of Sydney, working morning, noon and night, studying political economics, and then you find yourself in India talking to a TAFE teacher and you think, I might do something else.
Mm.
What happened? What was that all about?
Yeah, I have a great affection for India. I've spent a lot of time there, and I realise as I say that, it's a real, like, eat, pray, love Julia Roberts moment, like a great affection for this. It's just a totally bonkers place, and even more bonkers today than it was when I was travelling around and learning about the place. But I guess I got to a little crisis moment where it's a crisis of identity and a crisis of direction, because I looked at what I'd done for the last few years and I thought about it. I'm like, I've been sitting at a desk working my ass off to get these pieces of paper. What does this actually mean? You know, because they might not even relate, they might not convert into a job.
Yeah.
You know, it's education for education's sake. That's good. But actually, Alison, maybe that's a bit selfish. Really what you should be thinking of is what's practical, what's useful. And what I knew of practical and useful was what my dad and my brother did, which was make stuff with their hands. And they could do things. Like, my family is a, you know, like, their house was just about built by my dad and, you know, a few of his tradie mates. So I got to this point and I was like, yeah, I'm going to do a trade. I'm going to go to TAFE. I will be an electrician. I thought about the trade, and I was sort of moving between carpentry or wasn't thinking, but it was this conversation I had with this TAFE teacher who was randomly in this cafe in Darjeeling in India. And I think he could see a book that I was reading or something. He just came up and said hello. And I was, I think I was actually writing about, because I do a lot of writing to help make sense of what's going on, and thinking about what I was doing next. And he was like, oh, absolutely, like, we need more women in the electrician trade. And quite often women do really well because they've got an eye for detail. A lot of blokes do crappy jobs and leave like wires all over the place. And the perfectionism, or like the tendency to perfectionism in women makes them better at being electricians. So I was like, all right, that's it. I've worked it out. I've done some thinking. I got some university degrees. Now I'm going to go do some like doing with my hands, you know. And I thought, does piano count? Probably not. And so that's why I had to get a trade. And yeah, it was that discussion with this bloke who was basically there to help the Indian government invest in or develop skills in renewable energy, because of course we were doing nothing on this front. So all the teachers were going elsewhere. And I thought that'd be a nice little synthesis of my life. Didn't happen though. The intention was there.
So what did you go off and build?
Oh, like tangibly?
For you. What did you do?
I continued with this master's. And yeah, like when we're talking before about this job in the Commonwealth government, that was sort of the Kickstarter. That's what got me, I guess, really focused about trying to be as effective as I could at influencing policymaking, influencing the cogs, so to speak, and not being the cog.
So you landed as the national, and when I say landed, you can explain how it happened, the national organiser at the CPSU. Tell us about that role, and you know, what were you passionate about achieving?
It was an interesting sidestep for me, because I'd realised from my time in government was I got experience and insights and vision into, at the time I was working in the Department of Finance, so I was working in budget, the process of policy, politics coming together with billions of dollars of public money around choices, and seeing the processes and the way that those policies came up, critiquing or analysing those policies, money going out the door, and getting an insight into politics. And it was an interesting position, because not many public servants, I think, can get to be that close to cabinet and see the processes. Pretty convinced that I didn't want to be in politics, but I wanted to influence it or influence decision making in some way. And I was looking for institutions that would enable me to help build and reweave working people back into each other in a way that helps them to build strength and to, you know, to rebuild communities, basically. And unionism for me is a big part of that. And for me, the CPSU, which is the Community Public Sector Union, it was my union. I was a delegate on the ground, one of the only union members, can assure you, at the Department of Finance. It's a very hostile place. But it was for me about like this righteous sort of, you know, conversion of my position coming from the floor is the language we use in union. I came from the floor. It's my industry. And so I was a delegate, a workplace representative, and then moving into an official sort of organising position was for me about putting into practice what I saw on the ground and really like wanting to step up and to help empower some of the most beautiful, beautiful minds, soft, beautiful people with so much capacity and just so intelligent, but are just being really, really crushed at the moment working under the current government. And I wanted to, for me, it was just, it was a tool to be able to get them together and say, like, it doesn't have to be this shit, basically. Like, we can actually come together, improve things like work-life balance. There are people who are working on, you know, 12-hour workdays consistently who are just on the edge of breakdown. And a lot of people don't know how bad it is inside the Commonwealth public sector. So for me, it was about getting close to the kinds of institutions I knew that I wanted to be a part of in terms of my work and feeding them into my, I guess, frameworks of how to build change. But it was also about doing what I thought was the right thing to do. I guess it was a logical step, because the other thing is, in government there's so much censorship.
Yeah.
So you can't have opinions that are public. You can't express yourself because they threaten your job all the time. So it was also about being able to open up the valve and just get out all the stuff I wanted to say, and say it to the faces of people who I knew couldn't say that back to me. But I knew that they were nodding furiously.
Okay. And whilst you were there, you were contracting into the Centre for Future Work, right?
Mm. Yeah. And that was such a wild time, because so Jim Stanford, he's the director of the Centre for Future Work. And I was following his work when he's in Canada. He's Canadian. And I was already, he was already on my radar. And then he moved to Australia and he set up the Centre for Future Work. And for me, it was just then I knew I was just hellbent on working out how to just get around the project, because the particular type of economics that Jim applies, and he pulls on lots of different schools. He's not, you know, orthodox. And he's focused on activist approaches, which is like applied. How do you apply economics in a way, such as through think tankery as a way to, that's a word I just made up, by the way.
Yeah, I was going
to say. It worked. To use economics for good, basically. And particularly his work on pedagogy and how to teach complex economic concepts to everyday people. That was stuff that was all really ding, 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 ding. Because these are all the reasons why I was pursuing education and, you know, I was wanting to find something that helped me to improve the lives of people. And so, yeah, once Jim moved over, I found a way to get noticed, just basically emails. And I started contracting while I was still organising. So it was pretty hectic time. I was, you know, 5 a.m. waking up, working till 9 a.m., rushing off, doing my full-time job, you know, early mornings, late nights, and, you know, but just very, very driven. I can't imagine another time in my life when I've been so driven and so willing to go without sleep because, yeah, it just felt like this is the work I wanted to be doing.
Mm. You had a motorcycle accident, 2017.
Mm.
It was pretty bad. It was very bad.
Mm.
I don't want to know. We don't want to hear all the details. But in terms of that experience, because you were in hospital for over a couple of months and you had a brain injury, what did that experience, what did you take out of that experience for you personally and the way that you look at life now?
Mm. Well, I guess I'd first of all like to say that it triggered a process of turning into myself and, you know, trying to harness the good life, so to speak. But I think it really just strengthened my resolve, and I really just doubled down on my efforts to just keep finding ways to be as effective and to produce more and do more. And
so listening to you for the last 45 minutes, I've been sprinting.
Yeah.
Really hard for a long time.
Mm.
That accident said, let's sprint a bit quicker. Or?
You know, there are things, right, I think the best way to frame it is I've been sprinting for a long time because I think who I am is a product of trying to have agency over things that I didn't really have full control over.
Yeah.
And I didn't have control over that accident either. Mm-hmm. And all I knew is I woke up in a hospital bed and I was told that I was like royally screwed up. And it took me a couple of days from the drugs to actually realise. I was still, you know, saying, I've got to go on a plane, I've got to go to the RTBU meeting, I've got to present this. And it took a while to settle. And I think what got me through that period was knowing that there was something on the other side. And I think that was really important. But I also kind of accepted that it happened and just set to making sure that when I got out and when I was able to walk and think and, you know, return to who I was and who I was trying to build, you know, that I would be clearer in that resolve, I guess. And I think one thing I definitely did learn is that I don't want to take risks in the same way that I had. And when I look at that accident, it was actually my second motorcycle accident. The first one, I crushed my foot and I had a whole bunch of, you know, musculoskeletal problems for many years and chronic pain. But this one was like, you know, the big mama. It was bad. And if I look back on not just this, but like experiences traveling overseas and, you know, lots of risk-taking behavior, which is kind of normal in your frame, in your mind when you're doing it. But I just decided that I should do what I can to not die, basically. I shouldn't, yeah. You know what I mean?
I think that's a good realization. So you don't ride motorcycles anymore.
Oh, no, I promised my mum I'd never do it again.
That's probably why.
And I think that's the thing is when you see your mum's face like that at your hospital bedside, like you just, you do whatever you can to not put that face on her again.
Yeah. Mm. Good move.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're at the centre of...
Centre for Future Work.
Thank you very much. You say that it's sort of a culmination of your life's work to date. And you sort of described it up front. With the work that you do today, what are you trying to achieve?
Well, yeah, good question. There are multiple things that we're doing all the time. But generally there's a vacuum in Australia right now around what our organisations can do. And I mean political parties, unions, community organisations, all of our – where our organisations are at and in terms of their strength and what needs to be done. I think we're – This gulf opening up, and I guess I see our job as being able to articulate what's going on in the economy, explain that, and explain the options, other things that we could be doing, other ways that we could be organising the economy to actually meet human need and, you know, address things like the climate crisis we're in. So it's... Sometimes it feels like a nebulous concept being in a think tank because you are in the realm of ideas. You are contesting the debate at a public level. But it's also about building up the capability of those organisations. And, you know, for me, I'm always asking the question, what is going on? What's going on in the economy? You know, and that's what has driven me to get to the point where I've picked up these frameworks and skill sets and studied it because I think it's one of the most important and powerful frameworks we have to talk about the world we're in, but there aren't many economists who are working for the interests of the majority of people. Most economists are employed in, you know, corporate banks or in government positions where they can't fully articulate their ideas. So there's a real dearth of people with economic understanding and education that are able to deploy that in a way that actually allows us to make sense of our world and change it. So I think that's what I see the Centre for Future Work's role as doing.
Cool. COVID-19 has changed the world. Your eyes, ears, heart and soul is into all of that analysis and data. And I get, you know, we get a few questions before we wrap up around what you foresee for the future. But I'm really interested, right? So last year, I think back personally and what I saw happening within the business that I work in and what my wife works in, that the time to actually think was minimized. There was so much action taking place because, you know, working from home and all of a sudden you're on all of these video calls and it's just back to back to back to back to back. How do you structure your work at the think tank to think? Because what I experienced was there was actually less time to think last year and more time to do. Did you experience that, or do you have really clear ways of working and methodologies that allow you that time to do the thinking? What do you do at 10 p.m. at night whilst you're staring at the ceiling?
All of the above. What is, I guess, not fully understood and maybe something I am always reminding myself is, like, I've been able to, in that time of crisis, do a lot because I've been thinking and writing and developing concepts and frameworks of understanding the world for many years. And I felt like one particular issue where there was just a gaping hole in the media and being able to talk about what was going on was around women and what happened when, the unpaid caring work of the household exploded and suddenly women were pulling out of their jobs. They were losing more of their jobs because they were often in those customer-facing sectors that were shut down at first. And free childcare was put on the table, then it was taken off. And suddenly, again, more women coming out the workforce. And it was just those fundamental questions of, like, jobs, incomes, caring, you know. These are actual economic concepts. And I felt like this is something I've been studying and thinking about for so many years. So when push came to shove and the crisis hit, I guess I trusted that I could just shoot from the hip mm-hmm. and know that the lens I was using was yep. going to work. So yep. I think it's about building up that lens, having the right method to build that lens. But I am, it's that feeling that I am falling behind in my theories and my concepts and being able to nurture that lens is always there. And it's something that you have to be so diligent and so disciplined about carving out that space. Even if you just sit there and it takes you, you know, half hour to get going, like putting aside that time to read something new, take a few notes. Just read. Like we're not reading enough and it's hard. It's much easier to put on Netflix and just chill out and just be a vegetable. Yeah. I feel that way sometimes too, but I guess I would appeal to people what we just have. That's not going to help us work out what to do next. Although always self-care is important. I don't want to,
yeah.
I'm probably not a shining example of that. So I think, yeah, do what you need to do to look after yourself in that time, but know that, nurturing that lens and feeding it all the time is important.
Like it. What are you watching on Netflix, by the way?
Ooh, you know what? I just finished a series. It's quite embarrassing. It's called Firefly Lane.
Oh,
it's terrible.
It's not embarrassing. I'm halfway through it.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I love chick flicks, rom-coms.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, Job caper, job seeker, from Firefly Lane to they're going to roll off shortly.
Mm, mm.
If you listen to the media and what the government's telling us, you know, the jobs that were lost back in March, April, May, we've filled those back at the back end of last year. If you have a look at the amount of money that was saved, I think it was quoted, well over $100 billion by the community that we will, the economy will come back. How do you see post the JobKeeper and JobSeeker being removed? What's going to happen?
Oh, well, first, because of the content of our discussion today, my heart immediately goes to all the people I know on the job seeker payment and all the coronavirus supplement. And once that's cut back, it is straight back into dire poverty. And I think Australia is going to see a massive expansion in the number of people who are without basic necessities. And that's not a good, nice society to live in. You know, none of us should want to create that world.
Yeah.
And there are 1.5 million people on the job seeker payment, but there are 2.5 million altogether on the supplement. That includes carers and single mothers, single parents, I should say. So that's a large number of people in our community that are going to struggle. In an economic, macroeconomic sense, what cutting JobKeeper and JobSeeker back represents is the removal of billions of dollars out of circulation in the economy, and circulation among people who are most likely to spend it because they have the highest needs. So we know that when those payments came in, those people were like their volume of consumption spending shot up, and wealthy people, they came down because they were sitting at home, not going out as much, had most of their needs already. They didn't have pent up demand, whereas the poor had, oh, I've been wanting a new jumper for a long time. I've been needing this and needing this, or bills to pay. So it's going to have an effect on the ability on consumption demand and spending. And what happens when there's less money being spent? It means small businesses aren't going to employ people, so there will be employment losses off the back of that. There might not be immediate job losses from JobKeeper being pulled out. I think there will in the arts industry. There's a lot of signs that they're going to really suffer. But what's going to happen is people's hours is going to drop right back. So incomes are going to drop. These are all, you know, big problems. I think it looks like the government's wanting to may go to an election soon. So I think they're going to find some way to smooth out these effects. And they are going to have to introduce new fiscal supports. Otherwise, we're going to see some pretty negative employment effects, which will be hard for them to hang their hat on and say, hey, like 80% of the jobs that we lost have come back, which, by the way, we should always question, because the level of employment can come back the same, but what about the quality of those jobs? And the research we've done at the centre shows that 62% of all of the jobs that came back in the second half of the year have been casual jobs. That was over 400,000 jobs, 2,200 a day. So there's a debate going on in industrial relations. The government's got a new bill on the table. Supposedly we need expanded employer power to use casual work because they are lacking confidence at the moment in being able to hire new casuals. And it's just, it's not borne out in reality. I guess what we're going to see in this period is, it kind of goes to your question about the future of work, is that the quality of jobs is declining. And if you're in a full-time, secure, permanent role with, you know, basic entitlements like sick leave and annual leave, you're going to be an increasing minority.
So why is it there's such a gap between what you see and you're passionate about and what the government puts out? Is it all election cycles, or why is there such a massive gap there? You can sort of see, an election might be called in the near future, therefore you want to have numbers to hang support behind. But why are they not seeing what you're seeing in the exact same way, that quality of jobs, for example, number of jobs, all those sorts of things?
Well, the government is representing a very vocal minority of business, and the very large businesses, the biggest ones, the most powerful ones in Australia, they have an interest in reducing wages and the quality of jobs, because if people are in insecure positions, they are more easily disciplined and they're more desperate for any work they can get, and therefore they're easier to pay less and to you can treat them poorer, and that saves them on their wages bills. So it's quite crass, but that's really what's going on, is that a small, very vocal and powerful layer of Australian business has captured government. And the government listens to them, and it's not in the interest of businesses overall to create an economy where we have, you know, millions of people in working poverty who are working jobs where they don't earn enough to buy things. It's definitely not in the interest of small business, who are often used as the framework to push through these pro-big business reforms. I mean, the short of it is the government doesn't see it this way because they don't want to. And because they don't care. And that's really, it's on, you know, organisations like, you know, like us at the Australian Institute, and all of us, you know, to start putting this into words and raising education and being able to articulate what's going on and how things can be done differently. Because I think a lot of Australian people think that private sector ownership and control of the economy is natural. Only businesses can create jobs, governments can't, which is, of course, not true. 16% of all employment or something like that is government work. Public sector jobs do exist. So there are pathways out, but it depends on dismantling a lot of very decades-long entrenched ideology about, you know, this sort of market fundamentalism, really, that says the market knows best. And it looks really, really bastardized under a post-COVID or a COVID crisis, because what it looks like is billions of dollars of public money going straight to businesses without any obligations on them and conditions on them to actually create good and meaningful jobs for people.
So we give you the Doolander's magic wand.
Mm-hmm.
What does Australia's economy look like? What's the mix? What's the influence of government on business? How would you, if you could do it all from scratch, how would you make it work?
I think I'd start with the Nordic countries as a model, and I would build out of that. I think actually Australians are social democratic at heart. I think they believe that there is a role for government in the provision of basic human services, all the things we need for any person to have a decent life. And so that means public education, public healthcare, a welfare safety net for people who get left behind, or that captures them, is always there. But then it's in the job space. That's where the question of who should have more of a role in determining how we work and how much we're paid. And that's how the economy is actually, how it functions. That's how we, you know, these bits of paper, these microphones, they're all made by humans, right? So, and machines at the same time together. So I think I have a lot of interest in Australia's experience of full employment policy, because it was our policy in the past, in the post-war period, to say that government was obliged to make sure there was enough investment in the economy that so that there were enough jobs produced. We have so much underutilization, millions of people who need more work right now. Why aren't we looking to government and asking them why aren't they creating an environment that requires business to invest? We've got record high profits, a lot of money sloshing around, none of it being reinvested. So it's a lot of short-term thinking and not a lot of long-term thinking. I think it's the role of government to create those frameworks of long-term thinking so that it's not any one business that is able to say, right now, this is going to help me get more money for my shareholders, but it's actually a government that creates the framework through, you know, employment policies, taxation policies, investment policies that says, here is where we want to go as a collective, all of us. We want to go in that direction in the next 20 years. And we're going to create an environment that, you know, incentivizes business to come to the table and invest to create jobs. But also government should be engaging in far more direct hiring. I think the Nordic countries have something like 35-40% public employment. It's very high. I think that kind of mix would be fine by my standards. So we start there. But I think more broadly, my approach to great change, social change, economic change, is that I'm democratic. I think that we should build up organisations that give people the capacity to raise what they think should be done. And I don't think democracy is just in politics, like being able to vote every few years. I think we should have, you know, more flourishing democratic spaces in our communities, in our schools. You know, Medicare was created in a democratic sort of framework too, where like the idea was that you'd have boards at a community level with experts in various fields and doctors and leaders in the community, and they'd come together and say, this is what our health needs are. And over time, that democratic fabric of Australia has been eroding. So for me, yeah, the organisation of an economy isn't just about electing a government at the top to determine it. It's about people being more a part of that discussion all the time and those processes.
That's a good answer.
Well, that's what you're good at, right?
You probably wave the wand on the AFL for Port Adelaide flag every now and then.
Oh. As in, like, become a dictator for the purposes of winning a flag?
Yeah.
I'm open to that, really. No, but the thing is that this is our year, so I don't need to be a dictator about it, because, like, this is Port Adelaide's year.
Yeah, no,
just
putting
it out there.
A magic year sport. Every year's our year.
Hey, clearly, go on.
Are you Richmond?
No. We're Hawthorn.
Oh, okay. Interesting take on your losses.
Well, hey, we need to bring this baby home. Mm-hmm. Probably the most important question that, you know, when Nick and I looked into the vast amount of information that there is to research on you, and I actually would have preferred that you did the research on you and gave it to me to ask better questions. But anyway, here we are. Is the last question is, can you teach Nick how to scat in a minute?
I can already do it.
Can you go?
Yeah. So okay. There's two things you got to know. One is it always starts with Scooby-Doo.
Oh, really? Well, that's in the scatting manual.
Yeah. Right. For the brief amount of education I looked into, it has to start with Scooby-Doo. Uh-huh. And if you can, this is what I learned, if you can sneak in Boomfrang, then you've mastered the art.
Right, okay.
So anyway, why don't you give us your level of scatting and I'll see if I can...
Follow
or just put some...
Just so you know how serious I am about doing this right,
yeah.
I've undone my jeans because they're a bit tight.
Is that a thing you do?
Like, well, I've been sitting here like breathing shallowly the whole time. Yeah, I realise, I've got all this capacity. Just undo the jeans. Yeah. It's like big meal, you know?
It comes from the diaphragm, right?
Exactly. Yeah. All right, how about we do trade, which is like I'll do a line and you can do it back to me.
Yeah. So you know the limit of my vocabulary here is...
I'll keep it simple. Give it simple. Yeah. Don't worry. All right. Mm-hmm. And I'll get a bit of a click going because we got a swing. Mm. Boy, doobie boy.
Scooby dooby doo doo.
You got a copy.
Boy, doobie boy.
Scooby dooby doobie doo.
Boy, doobie boy.
Boomfrang. Over to you, Blake.
Love it.
That was amazing. Alison Pennington, thank you so much for joining us on the Doolanders. What an amazing life you've led thus far, and it's so short. We can't wait to see what you do next.
Oh, my absolute pleasure to sit here and have a chat with you guys. It's been, a joy.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alison. So you meant to copy?
I thought that's what you said.
Yeah, but that's all right. You ended up improvising and it was cool.
It was cool.
Well, you
mark cool. That down.
Did it worked though, right?
It did. It did work. It was perfect. Yeah, geez, you're good. You sound great, Nick.
Yeah, you got some work.
I like you got Boomfrang in though.
I was a Boomfrang. I went Boomfrang.
Boom is cool as well.
Yeah.
Zoolander audience, how awesome was that ending?
Wow. Wasn't she amazing? Like seriously, Alison, she's swinging you and you came in. I think
she supported me really well.
You came in and it was like a brick had entered the atmosphere. It was just, but no, good effort, mate. Really good effort. I was proud of you.
Thanks.
Because I looked at you and the fear in your eyeballs when she threw to you. But what she said to you leaning in, you just copy what I do.
So, you get to a point of fear where you can't see properly, you can't hear properly. And it's just like, what are the words? Oh, the words are Scooby-Doo.
And that's all I've got. Isn't Alison a remarkable human being?
She certainly is. And like so determined. It's so unusual to find someone so young who knew exactly what she wanted to do. And once she stuck to it, she knew she had purpose and she's just driven it home.
What I found fascinating was her love for music and the musicality that filled her as a person, and that's carried through from her, days as a kid right through to now, to the other end of being a political economist, spending her days, each waking moment in the depths of analysis on modelling and data and analysis, and so diverse, so, unbelievably different.
And she's found an outlet, though. Screaming at a football team, which must be really therapeutic.
Well, I think screaming at Port Adelaide you would have done a lot of screaming over the over the journey. What I found most inspiring was where she came from and what she had to do in order to get to where she is today.
Yep.
I think about us and, you know, really the privilege that we've been afforded through the work of our parents and just what we've grown up in to be able to cruise, in many ways, cruise through our teens into university, whereas she's done it hard from the get-go.
Yeah.
And, you know, worked how many jobs to get through uni?
A lot, and had to study part-time because she couldn't afford to not have the jobs to keep up all the payments. So it is incredible. It was the making of her. And, yeah, tough decision if you were to say, would you do that again if you had the choice? And you just don't know what the outcome would be, I suppose. But she's made the most of everything.
Yeah, sure has. Can't wait to see what she does next. All right, mate, take us out. Let's do a little bit of...
I think this time it's just you solo scatting.
Skippity-bop-bop-ba.
Oh, dear me. See you later, Doolanders. Do-do-do-do-do.